From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Basketball fans from around the great state of Michigan, and those of you here at the Palace from across the world, stay on your feet. Time to meet and greet the Ballers, representing the Detroit Pistons.
Talk about hoopla. The pregame show at the Palace in Auburn Hills, Michigan, rocked for last night's Game 3 of the NBA Championship. The hometown team didn't let fans down. After two humiliating losses, the Detroit Pistons took the San Antonio Spurs 96-79. But if you missed the game, you had plenty of company. Pro Basketball's signature event is a television flop so far. Ratings are way down. More viewers were interested in B-list celebrities on ABC's Dancing with the Stars than in basketball's premier event. Once upon a time, in the 80s and 90s, the NBA absolutely ruled. Larry, Magic, Michael, and Dr. J made even non-sports fans giddy. Today, it's a different story, a fascinating story, about how a genuine cultural phenom, a sports supernova, can lose its luster. Tonight on Point, the NBA off its game. You can join the conversation. Do you still love the game? Are you one of the millions who are no longer watching? Why not? What changed, you or the game? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Auburn Hills, Michigan, is Jack McCollum, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He is covering his 14th NBA final. Jack, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
There's a lot we want to catch up with here, but help us just with the finals, with the championship for starters. Detroit still down by one. How's it looking? What's the buzz around the championship?
Well, the buzz is uncertainty, because I thought the Spurs were a better team. I still think they're a better team. But the strange thing about the first three games, Tom, has been the decisiveness. You know, it's been three double-digit victories. It just seemed that one team has let down in each of the games. You know, the first two was Detroit. And last night was a close game until Detroit went on a rally and killed them in the fourth quarter. So that's kind of been the storyline. It's a very uncertain pattern. I still like San Antonio to prevail.
Jack, I have to admit, we're talking tonight about how big the NBA was and how it's fallen some here. And I have to admit, I may be part of that fall. I wish you'd give us a sketch of these two teams, because I've got to confess, I don't really have a deep sense of each of them.
Well, I think, you know, at the top of the program, you mentioned the key to the whole thing, which was you mentioned, you know, four names. I mean, you mentioned Magic, Larry, Michael, and Dr. J.
Yeah.
By and large, this was a league that always thrived upon personalities. And for a variety of reasons, which we may or may not have enough time to talk about, there are no personalities to seize people, and therefore the game itself, the pro game, has never been the kind of thing like baseball, you know, the American, great American sport, or football, the great corporate gathering sport on Sunday. Pro basketball has never had that. It's always needed the personalities. The personalities on these teams are either faceless by design, which would be an example of San Antonio's Tim Duncan, who might be the best player in the league, but doesn't really give two hoots about presenting himself.
Yep.
Or it might be the kind of negative personalities, which a lot of people perceive, the Detroit Pistons with Rasheed Wallace, you know, a bunch of guys with cornrows and tattoos, which gets into a whole cultural phenomenon about whether the players themselves are the reason people don't like them, or whether people are reacting to their outward appearance and that there's a racial aspect to it.
And we'll talk about that tonight, but of course when Dennis Rodman had his crazy hair and tattoos, everybody still loved it. You write, Jack, about the San Antonio Spurs being very representative of the international influx in the NBA.
Well, I think one of the things we're going to see is there's a guy in the series who has emerged as an elite player. His name is Manu Ginobili. He has good looks. He has smarts. He's multilingual.
And a passport from Argentina.
Right. He's from Argentina, played in the Italian League, speaks three languages, good-looking guy, swashbuckling type of style, the exact style you think would embrace. Well, is America going to embrace someone with a Latin name? You know, it's someone who isn't named Larry, or is it named Michael? His name is Manu Ginobili. He is the guy that could emerge from this series as the real star. It's going to be interesting to see if the NBA in this country can make a marketing phenomenon out of him.
And look toward Detroit for a minute. Give us a quick sketch of the team there. Everybody remembers in their game with the Pacers when things got really wild and woolly and into the stands with fists flying. What's Detroit's profile?
Well, Detroit's profile is interesting because in many ways they represent the kind of qualities that we are supposed to embrace in this country. Last year, first of all, they were underdogs. They came together as a team. They don't have superstars. They play very hard. They play very unselfishly. But that has not translated to people liking them. They see a bunch of, once again, I get back to it, cornrows and tattoos. You look at Rip Hamilton, who's their shooting guard. Rip Hamilton is an intelligent, thoughtful, fundamentally sound basketball player, and America just will not embrace him. Rasheed Wallace, tattooed, a human technical foul machine. I think he's, you know, a public relations disaster. I don't think he should do some of the things that he does on the court that gets people to turn against him. But once again, he's a team player. You know, he's a fundamentally sound player. Their roster is full of those type of guys who you would think would have some of these qualities that we like, but it is just not translating at all to the American public. Some people don't even know they're the defending champions.
Remind me, one of these fellows played video games for 20 minutes through a press conference just the other day and didn't win any reporter love with that.
Well, you know, that's Rasheed. Rasheed Wallace sort of dances to his own drummer. He will not. I'm wearing a T-shirt right now that says both teams played hard, because at a memorable press conference 2 years ago when they made Rasheed attend every question that was asked him, he leaned into the microphone and went, "Both teams played hard," which is his brand of humor, which actually, when you think of it, is kind of funny.
It is
but
funny.
These guys have not bought into the necessity. Some of them have, but a lot of them have not bought into the necessity of public relations the way the league did, the way they did back when Magic, Michael, Larry, and Dr. J was playing, for the reasons that business-wise the league was a disaster then. They bought into the fact that, hey, we got to do something to repair it with the public. Now, some of the business things that are going on, counterintuitively to the public relations aspect, yeah, are doing very well. The players are not plugged into that necessity of kind of a communal exchange.
And it turns out those guys were naturals. Jack, you were at the meeting on Sunday when NBA Commissioner David Stern warned that there may be a lockout coming here, as we saw in the NHL very recently. What's the situation? Where are negotiations between players and owners?
Well, the collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of the season. The end of the season is always officially July 1st, even though it's before that. And the collective bargaining agreement expires, at which time, if there is not an agreement, there will be a lockout, meaning that the NBA locks out the teams. There can be no business done. There can be no trades made, no personnel moves made. And it's funny, you know, everybody recognizes what an absolute public relations disaster this would be. Here's a league fighting to keep whatever base it had, possibly following the lead of hockey, which shot itself, you know, in the foot throughout the winter.
Sure did.
Going to sort of lemming-like heading toward this cliff. And I don't think there's going to be a settlement because it's June 15th. It's 2 weeks. There's no talk settled. And there's a real animosity has grown up between Billy Hunter, the head of the players' union, and David Stern, when it looked, in fact, back in January and February, that they were going to get a deal done expediently, and that's not going to happen. I predict there will be a lockout, and America's remaining NBA fans will go, "My God, you know, what are they doing?"
What now, Jack? Walk us through the issues there. David Stern saying it's a tragedy if this doesn't work out. He says the players would get 57% of NBA revenue, which is now $3 billion, he points out, as opposed to $75 million in 1976. He says, what, that's not enough, 57% of $3 billion?
Well, I mean, all the, and the usual answer to that is the union answer, which is that all the owners are making money, which is true. I think what's gone on here, to a certain extent, is Stern has won so many battles. Even though he presides over this league that it's on tentative public relations ground, he is so widely perceived as the most successful commissioner that Billy Hunter, the union agent, the head of the union, always feels that, you know, I think he feels if he makes a deal too quickly or he doesn't take some kind of stand, it's once again going to be perceived that Stern is running ramshod over the players' union. And there's not only that going on, but there's some individual agents lobbying Billy Hunter, you know, not to make a deal that quickly because some of the things in the new contract are going to cost them money.
The average $5.5 million salary doesn't sound too bad. We just got another minute here, Jack. What about the player, the minimum age limit? That's a big issue this year.
Yeah, you know, that's always been, I think that is the total bunch of crap issue, and it's going to end up, although there's a lot of talk about it because it's kind of a sexy issue, that's going to end up being a compromise issue. And from the beginning, I think that really was. There's a lot of players, in fact, that would rather have the age limit on because the older players, tend, you know, if there's not 18-year-old kids in there getting
right,
their money,
right.
You know, they don't necessarily want LeBron James in the league any more than the league does. That's going to turn out to be a compromise issue. It's going to go to 19 instead of 20 as the league said it wanted, instead of 18 like the players said they wanted. And the real issue, which you hit on it, is bucks, because it always is, no matter what anybody said. And they better get the thing taken care of, or the league's going to go public relations-wise further down the tubes than it is.
Jack McCollum, you've got us kicked off well. Thanks for the tip-off here. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, see you later.
Jack McCollum, senior sports writer for Sports Illustrated, covering his 14th NBA final in Auburn Hills, Michigan this week. We're talking tonight about the NBA off its game. You can join us. Do you still love this game? What's taken the air out of the NBA? What made it a cultural phenom in the 80s and 90s and a bust today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the NBA off its game, even this week, finals week. The NBA, the sport of stars, of Jordan, of Bird, of Magic, maybe falling out of sync with the culture. We want to know what you think. What made it huge? What's missing now? Or have the country's taste just changed? And is it the game, or the players, or those darn foreigners? Is it the thug factor? Is that just code word for race? How do you read what's going on with the NBA? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from New York by Sam Walker, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Sam, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. It's my pleasure.
And from Sanford, North Carolina tonight, Bob Ryan is with us, sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Tom.
Bob, let me put it to you. Sam first got my head turned to this, I have to admit. I haven't followed it as closely as I used to, and I saw him writing in the Wall Street Journal. He said there used to be something elemental about watching the NBA playoffs. This year, the spell is tenuous. It may be wholly broken. NBA, what, the TV ratings down 33% in the first two rounds. NBA licensed apparel down 33% in sales. The league has lost about half its network television audience in 7 years, he says. The implication is that a larger cultural force is working against the NBA. Bob Ryan, what do you say? What's going on?
Well, the interesting thing about all this is that this cultural force seems to be working against the NBA domestically. It certainly isn't hurting it internationally. And that's the larger question as to the interesting thing is that basketball as an entity is booming internationally more than it ever has, even if the NBA isn't so big here. There are so many reasons. I listened to Jack, and Jack and I go back a long way. We've seen a lot of games together. And he hit a lot of the things, and he talked specifically about the personality cults that the NBA propagated back in the 80s and the early 90s with the big three. If you throw in Dr. J, the big four: Michael, Magic, Larry, and Dr. J.
Yep.
And people did. Affix on them, and also the Celtics and Lakers were larger than life romantic franchises that had interesting compare and contrast contrasting situations anchored at each end of the continent, and people were able to take sides and latch onto that. That had a lot to do with it. It's widely perceived among many of us that the golden age of the NBA was essentially from 1980 and to about the end of Michael Jordan's first era until when Michael retired in 93. It ended. You can draw a line right there.
But is this a natural ebb and flow that any sport faces, Bob, or did something particular go wrong?
Leonard Coppett believed, and 35 years ago, he was saying that the NBA had better face up to the fact that it will never be a widespread sport equivalent to baseball or football, that it was going to have regional pockets of interest, and so be it. Live with that, go with that, accept it, and go on.
But it wasn't true. It wasn't true.
It was wrong because now, for example, you've got a team playing for a championship where this discussion is meaningless in San Antonio. Nobody would know what you're talking about.
Right. They're fired up.
In San Antonio, everyone's enraptured with the NBA. And San Antonio is a city that wasn't on anyone's radar screen in 1970 when Leonard Coppett predicted that the NBA would never be more than a sport with pockets of interest.
Still, that's regional, and it did have its national day in the sun. I mean, there was a time when it was absolutely national.
Right.
Everybody was here.
You know, one of the things that the NBA, in my judgment, has always been subject to vast misconceptions. Many people have never quite gotten it right about the NBA. It was always better product than college basketball in the 60s, yet people didn't know it. It took the Knicks to put the NBA on the map in 1970. I don't think Sam would disagree with that.
No way.
And they attracted people to the sport by virtue of being in New York and all the publicity machinery that was available in New York and all the glamour that New York could provide.
Yeah.
And they really were, that Knick team of 69-70 was a turning point team in helping establish the NBA. The Celtics won 11 championships in 13 years, and the Knicks did more in 1 year to advance the cause of the NBA than the Celtics were able to do in their 13 years of tyranny over the NBA.
Bob Ryan, stand by. Sam Walker, I want to get you in here. You're the one who turned our heads to this. You painted it large here, and you draw it down to a very specific point of interest, maybe a failing or a vacuum in the NBA around statistics. But before you take us to that final analysis and solution, what's your big interpretation, or does it all come down to statistics?
I think Bob nailed it on the head. I think you can draw a line through. I think it's 1998 when Jordan hit that shot in Utah, and I think that was really the moment that everything changed for the NBA. I really think what happened with the NBA is they just had this incredible run of good fortune. I mean, you can't invent characters like Larry and Magic, and you couldn't invent Michael Jordan. I mean, and the things that he did physically were so spectacular that I think people kind of got used to looking at the NBA, and it was a kind of almost a sensual experience. I mean, watching these guys play, and the athleticism was so amazing, and the charisma was so incredible.
People said, this is art. This is like ballet.
Exactly. And, I mean, you know, I think when he was in Paris, I mean, people were asking him if he was human, if he was a god. I mean, he was, you know, it was that sort of level of reverie. And
but there's still amazing athletes out there still doing amazing things. Why don't we see it as magical?
That's the funny thing. I mean, the level of athleticism is just as good now in the league, if not better. But, you know, what happened is I think the NBA had this incredible run of good fortune, and I think they just didn't realize. If you look at a lot of sports now, I think golf has this problem with Tiger Woods. It's what comes after Tiger Woods, and hopefully they'll have a good long run with him. But look at boxing. Boxing's just a shambles, and you had, you know, the iconic fights of the 70s, and after that there's just been this vacuum, you know, after Tyson sort of never really met his potential. You know, what happens is you have to be able to move on your feet and to shift paradigms, and I think that's where David Stern has really failed. He hasn't been able to change course from this sort of cult of personality. I mean, you know, everyone, Jack was talking a lot about how we aren't able to embrace these players in the NBA now, but I think the real problem is, you know, why should we embrace them? Why do we have to embrace them? I mean, you know, they're not, whatever their personalities are, I think there's been something, you know, the athletes have been something of a liability to the league. You know, look at baseball. I mean, you've got guys like Vlad Guerrero who doesn't even speak English. And, you know, you've got, you know, Pedro Martinez who, you know, went for years without even talking to the press.
So you're saying bar the door, throw out the foreigners, make it homeboys again?
No, I think that's great. I mean, I think we love those baseball players. I think it works for baseball. I don't think we need communicative athletes because I think fans have a different way of engaging with baseball than they do with the NBA, and they're given more options. I think the NBA needs to find ways to give fans other opportunities, other ways to engage with basketball.
We're going to come back and look at what you would suggest for that, Sam. And Bob, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Bobby is calling from New York City. Bobby, what do you know? What do you see?
Well, how you doing? First of all, I'm a first-time caller. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
I'm in New York.
Okay, and what do you see there, Bobby?
Well, my question, my statement was just that I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that there's no embracing of these players because the players don't really deserve it. I mean, what's going on is that you've got a lot of these kids, and I call them kids, that are basically in the league right now. They're very, very good and very talented, but they don't have any, there's no molding of these characters. There's none of that that comes through. And the public can't really embrace them because they don't want to be embraced.
Bobby, I'm reading here, you own a bar in New York. What do you see there?
Yeah, I mean, 3 years ago when I opened up, and in playoff times, my bar was full of people just watching the game. We're not a sports bar or anything. We're just a bar. We've got a regular little television in the corner. That's it.
Yep.
But people would watch. I mean, I'd have people sitting at my bar from 5 o'clock on. Now the game's on, the playoffs now, and people aren't even watching it. They don't watch it. They don't pay attention to it. And the only time they do pay attention to it is when there's a big brawl or something.
And you say it's because the players don't deserve their embrace. Let us pick that up, Bobby. Thanks for calling. I want to bring another voice in, if I may. David Steele joins us from Troy, Michigan tonight. He's sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun. David Steele, we're delighted to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
So we've been reading you, and you hear the conversation tonight. You hear Bobby there in New York saying 3 years ago in his bar everybody was watching. Now nobody's watching. He says these players don't deserve to be watched. What do you make of that, David Steele?
I actually found that interesting, and I'm glad that I got a chance to hear him before I came on, because I think it's sort of indicative of the way that the NBA doesn't cut across all the different cultural and social and societal boundaries the way it did during its heyday. And I think that that Bob Ryan made a great point in saying that we really came out of a real golden era for the NBA when Michael Jordan retired. It was like two straight decades of just maybe the highest level of NBA basketball that there's ever been, and they're more charismatic and attractive superstars than ever. And a lot of the superstars that have come along while being just as talented and in a lot of cases just as vibrant, they just haven't connected widespread across all of America. But they do connect in certain pockets, and in other pockets, like the one that the caller described a little while ago, they don't connect in any way at all. And it's been a real disconnect in certain areas and a complete connect in others, but those two sides just haven't joined each other.
But our caller Bobby's from New York City. That's hardly an out of the way place. I mean, if you can't connect, you know, if you do connect there, you've got it, and if you can't, you got to wonder what's going on. We had Jack McCollum on earlier. He was talking about, you say there are cultural lines that aren't being successfully crossed here. He was talking about cornrows and tattoos, and people say thug life and all that. Is there a race issue here? If there is, why wasn't there when it was, you know, Michael and Magic and Dr. J?
Well, I think that in every area of entertainment, there are always black superstars and black stars of all, or stars of other colors that have crossed over for one reason or another, or for various reasons.
No kidding.
Michael Jordan was one of them. Magic Johnson was one of them. But certain players like the Allen Iversons and the Shaqs and the Kobes, they really haven't in a big way. And it's hard to really put your finger on exactly why some of them have and why some of them haven't, but I think it's certainly a factor, and that's when you start to hear the things about people having problems with cornrows and tattoos and calling them thugs and that sort of thing, and that's going to turn a lot of people off, and it's going to make people certainly, and they say the word, they hate the NBA, and not even that they dislike it or disdain it or ignore it, that they really have a passionate dislike for it, where they might not have that for other sports that they tend to ignore. And yet again, there are certain other audiences, and a lot, they're not necessarily defined by race, they sometimes defined more by age or generation or culture, that are really embracing the NBA. It's just not the sort of area in which that's going to be a widespread appeal to the sort of audience and the sort of sponsorship as well that the NBA had become accustomed to.
Bob Ryan, what do you think? We want to come in, you know, very surgically and specifically here, but here's all this thug life attitude, I don't know, culture talk. Do you see that as a barrier to more popularity for the NBA now, or is it something else entirely?
You know, we fought this through this, I thought, many over the last 30 years. Race was an extreme problem in attracting widespread audiences in the NBA going back 25 or 30 years ago. I don't think there's any question about that. The NBA had to fight through an awful lot of problems in that regard. Dr. J had a lot to do with as a crossover figure, if you will, change some people's attitudes and get them inside the tent, as it will. And I think that I thought that battle had been completely fought.
Yeah.
I think it's been rekindled a little bit. Allen Iverson is viewed as a threatening personality by a lot of white fans. A lot of old-line white fans do not like Allen Iverson. They don't like his looks, and that's the end of that. And there's, and it's funny, and there was an allusion made earlier about Rodman, and Rodman transcended all that.
Yeah.
He was never viewed as threatening. He was always viewed as the class clown. Maybe that was the reason.
Hmm.
But he was never viewed as threatening. Rasheed Wallace with his, you know, is a very polarizing player. And yet Ben Wallace, who's got the cornrows one night and the full-blown afro right out of the 70s, right out of Superfly the next night, is anything but. He is a completely orthodox, old-fashioned, hard-working player, blue-collar, got a guy with, that should appeal to everybody, and I think he does, and for the most part. I don't think this is the real. But let me just say one thing.
Yes, please.
Form here. I don't think anybody's mentioned style play. When the Bulls were in their heyday, and the first Bulls era ended in 93 with Michael's first retirement, and the second one ended in 98.
Yep.
When the Bulls were in their heyday, they were masking by their own individual glamour, glitz, and mega aura the fact that the league play overall was becoming exceptionally boring, that the league had become the prisoner of ironclad coaches who were imposing defense uber alles and ignoring offense, that the biggest myth in all of professional sports was and is that the NBA is a player's league. It is a player's league until the game starts. And once the game starts, it's in the grip of the coaches who determine how the game will be played and who will play.
And they're dumbing down the play? They're diminishing it?
What I want to get at is this way, for that this year was the most entertaining year the NBA has had since Michael's retirement.
Yeah.
But best one in the last 10 years, thanks in large measure, but not exclusively, to the Phoenix Suns. And San Antonio is a completely jiggered team that once was boring, that now with Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker is a vibrant, exciting, explosive team, and then it still has Tim Duncan. And they are so entertaining, and they should be embraced by America, and yet the damage done by the 12 years of dreary sludge ball is so pervasive that people refuse to acknowledge how the Spurs are in fact a very exciting team.
And those ratings down 33%. Tom is calling from Wendell, North Carolina. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Your guest just mentioned most of what's wrong with the NBA, but I'll just review it.
Give us your take, Tom.
One, too much money. Two, no home support. Look at Shaq. He went from the East Coast to the West. Now he's back on the East Coast. And you don't get a sense of being on the team, or, you know, if it's a bad team, you root for them. If it's a good team, you root for them.
Too many trades, too much moving around.
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing is, basketball is a ballet out there. And I think your last guest mentioned this. Basketball is a ballet. Nowadays, you look at on TV, and you might get two passes. What happened to the pick and roll? What happened to the back door? What happened to the give and go? And if you look at old films of basketball, Chamberlain and Russell actually tried jumping straight up and trying to block their shot, not hitting each other, going to the foul line. You know, it just slows the game down.
Tom, we got it, but Bob Ryan says it's super entertaining. If we just pay attention this year, David Steele, what do you say?
Yeah, this goes back to what Bob said earlier about perception. You know, I think that, you know, the way the league played this year was a humongous upgrade stylistically from the way it's been in past years. And I think people have kind of rose-colored glasses about how things used to be. I would have to think, and I'm not really old enough to go all the way back to the heyday of Wilt and Russ, but I tend to think it was a pretty physical game back then as well, that it wasn't just strictly a ballet. But I don't think there's any question that the style of play had really begun to slow down. I think coaching had a lot to do with it. I think it just really, really tied things down really terribly. It's really suffocated the creativity of the players. And the NBA also went through this terrible stage where when they started seeing the popularity and the style of play start to slow down, they started changing rules every year. They they really reacted a little panicky in a lot of ways in the way they were marketed and promoted and tinkered with the rules for a long time. And nothing really changed until teams began to really start to open it up within the last couple of years. And the ratings right now just aren't reflecting it, and it's really kind of unfortunate.
Sam Walker, I want to hear you on the same thing. We've got a minute before the break here, but how do you see the play today? If people come back and watch, are they going to see that beautiful ballet on the court or something else?
You know, I think the whole problem is the NBA is selling the wrong thing. I think they really need to get back to the game itself and, you know, away from the personalities. And I agree. I think the Phoenix Suns, I wish they played on the East Coast, because I didn't get to watch them a lot. I think the quality of play is great. And again, you know, I think they need to the league needs to start focusing on the game. You know, basketball is a universal game, and I don't believe there are places where it's popular and places where it's not. I mean, if you look at participation in recreational activities, more people have played basketball than football and baseball and all these other sports that are more popular. Golf, I mean, all these other sports that are doing better. You know, I think the problem is that we all have an understanding and appreciation of the game, but we're not being sold basketball. We're not being, no one's talking about the game, the X's and the O's. Everyone's talking about the bling bling and who's driving what, you know, and the personalities. But that's what we need to get away from.
Back to the game, back to what's really beautiful. Sam Walker, Bob Ryan, David Steele, please stand by. I've got to take a short break here. Listeners, you can join us. We're talking tonight about the NBA off its game. What do you think? If the players get locked out, do you care? And what makes a whole sport rise and fall? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the NBA off its game, star power down, ratings down, excitement down. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is it the thug factor? Is that just code for race? And if it is, why wasn't race a factor when Michael and Magic and Barkley and Ewing ruled? What does the NBA need to get its game back? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We've got an all-star team with us tonight. David Steele of the Baltimore Sun, Bob Ryan with the Boston Globe, and Sam Walker of the Wall Street Journal. Right now, Alan is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Alan. What do you say?
Thank you very much. Greetings from Packer country, which is 12 months out of the year, I should add.
Yeah.
I want to give you the perspective of someone who owns an advertising agency. And granted, we're in a smaller market here. I'm buying probably in 10 or 12 markets in three states. I've been in business nearly 25 years.
So you're trying to decide whether to buy ads in the basketball broadcast.
That is correct.
Okay.
My primary function in this regard is buying media.
Okay.
And I can tell you that, of course, the ratings are important. The ratings are always important. But where I want to weigh in on this, and let me just add that I'm a native Hoosier, and this is a basketball family.
All right.
I have a daughter that plays. This is the first year I have bought no NBA for any of my clients.
Why?
I have been in NBA games right up through the finals for years, and it comes down to this. It's not race. It's bad behavior. And I'd refer you to a couple of things. You've just mentioned a number of gentlemen that have got a whole lot of class. Magic, Michael Jordan, Dr. J, Charles Barkley, and with regard to Sir Charles, I would say that I heard him on Talk of the Nation perhaps a month or so ago talking about his book, Who's Afraid of a Large Black Man,
right.
And he made it very clear, this is not about race, this is about bad behavior, this is about people who are making a cult of prison chic, if you will.
And you don't want the products that your people are advertising associated with that, so you're out.
There is an ethical... It's not all about numbers, Tom. I have an ethical responsibility to be certain that my clients are in programming that none of their customers or anyone in our communities around here or the community that's being advertised in has this sort of problem.
That's a pretty tall order to fill, but let us pick it up, Alan. Thanks for your call. David Steele, what do you say? Bad behavior.
I'm really surprised to hear that before. I mean, I that doesn't surprise me to hear that that's the perception out there. But I wonder why that's not a problem in any of the other sports. And it's interesting because another caller earlier mentioned other issues like too much money and free agency and things like that.
Right.
And these are all problems that are shared and common with every other professional sport and a lot of the college ones as well. And bad behavior falls into the same category. And I think it's also interesting that Charles Barkley's now become a commentator on this, knowing what his history was. When he was an NBA player, when he was one of the most popular players during the most popular era in NBA history. So I'm very curious, and that's something I don't have an answer to, is why that perception is so rife now compared to the way it had been at other times in the game's history.
But are you saying it's a misperception?
It's so
is it wrong?
It's not a problem in any other sport.
Is it wrong? I mean, you're talking relative to other sports. Okay, we get it. But is it wrong that, I mean, has behavior become worse in pro basketball?
It's hard to say whether it's become worse. I think that the perception of the players has become worse, and I think a lot of it does have to do with how they look. And there's certainly some bad actors in this league. And without question, the fight out in Auburn Hills earlier this year,
yeah,
when they climbed to the stands, I mean, there's no way, no easy way to overcome something like that. I mean, that left a stain on the sport that it's going to be a long time before it overcomes. It's probably affecting how the ratings are going right this very second.
Bob Ryan, is Allen being too persnickety in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, or has he got a point?
I certainly can't speak for Allen's situation in the far-flung regions of the fine state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But I just want to point out, this is a tribute to the incredible PR mechanism of the National Football League, which has at least as high a percentage of quote-unquote deviance as the NBA, and I would submit, frankly, more, and yet you don't hear about it the way you do or think about it in those terms because they're hidden behind all that armor,
yep.
And you don't even know what they look like, whereas, the perceived deviance in the NBA are out there in their underwear for all to see,
yep.
And I think that has a lot to do with it, and that's the difference between the end with the how the NFL has positioned itself as somehow as right there with apple pie, motherhood, and Chevrolet, and the truth is anything but, whereas the NBA seems to take the brunt of all this, this bad perception.
And you'd like to be fighting for the top rung, not over who's on the bottom. Let's get another call. Robert's calling from Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you say?
I got you today. I have a couple of comments. The reason I'm calling is I am one of those viewers who tuned off a few years ago, and I'm an average person.
Yeah.
And this year has come back. First, I want to tell you why I tuned off and why I came back.
Okay.
I tuned off when Shaquille O'Neal went to Los Angeles. And he just, and the impression I just got was he wasn't really playing basketball, and he did was threw his weight around, and then off the basketball, all he did was try to make money.
And now you're back. Why are you back, Robert? Do you agree with Bob Ryan? Is the game back?
And then I am back this year. I just tuned in one time, and then I saw the San Antonio Spurs. I saw what
yeah.
Tim Duncan was doing.
Yeah.
And I connected again with him because of his history. Just the way I connected with Michael Jordan.
And what about the young kids? What about the young kids playing now, Robert? What do you think about that?
I have a problem, a huge problem with that, because they're not playing for the love of the game. They are playing because they want fame and they want money.
Well, so what's new?
Before they get into the NBA, and something ought to be done about that.
Robert, we got it. Thanks for your call, Sam Walker. What about the young recruits? Is it made the game more rough, more raw? These guys come in with less history. You don't see them play in college much. You don't know who they are.
I just think really fans are tired of caring about the personalities of players. I just think we're over it. I mean, I think if you want to, if you're really interested in personality, you can watch reality TV. I think we don't want to have to care about these kids. We want to be able to admire their athletic ability, and they have a lot of it. The problem is, that's not the sort of face that we're being shown. I mean, I think what we lack with the NBA that we have with other sports is a language for talking about it that's different from just the personalities of players. I think in the NFL, there's a great fantasy component. I think fans are very interactive. And I think in baseball, there's a whole statistical element. There's another way to engage with the game. So, the real problem here is that, when it comes to the NBA, it's just we just haven't figured out a way to sort of engage on a different level. And I think
you're saying it needs to get more geeky to juice up the online stats and make it a geek's paradise somehow. How do you do that with the basketball?
Well, I think what you need to do is really find some way that the new fans are different. New fans are interactive. They're more analytical. They care more about the X's and O's. They care more about strategy. They identify better with general managers and owners. And frankly, I think a lot of people who are big fans of baseball or football, I mean, they really see the players as laundry. They're just guys who are, genetic freaks, a lucky sperm club, guys who just, have some sort of natural gift. I mean, I don't think we need to revere the players. I think what we need is we're all getting more analytical. I think people spend a lot of time at computers. I think the Internet has really changed the way we interact with sports because there's so much more information available. There's so much more that we can know and so much more that we can analyze.
So figure out how to lay the stats on professional basketball, and you may bring those people to the table. Of course, Phil Jackson's coming back now in L.A. Bob Ryan, what do you say?
Well,
is it going to be out in the cold for another 10 years?
Very interesting point Sam makes, but I think there's one thing I would take issue. I think it's just inherent in basketball that you are going to have these people as people, not as as pawns, not as as the laundry that he referred to as it is in baseball and football.
Because they're right out there.
Because they are, in fact, there in these skimpy uniforms, and they're and they are faces that you can really study. I have I've been following the sport now closely, I'd say 40 years, since I became the student became a student in Boston and started going to Celtic games.
It's a long time. Yeah.
And you always come away with a visceral impression about the style and the personalities of players on both teams. You can't; it's unavoidable in a way that it is 100% avoidable in football and mostly avoidable in basketball and hockey too. Basketball is different.
Basketball, right out there, as you say, in their underwear. You can't avoid the people. Well, it's going to be amazing to see what happens this year. And if the crowds come back, if it becomes that national obsession again, we'll be watching, Bob Ryan, to see if others agree that it's got its juice back. But we're out of time. Bob Ryan with the Boston Globe, wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining. And David Steele with the Baltimore Sun, terrific having you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And Sam Walker, you got us started down this road with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for joining us tonight,
Sam. You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Senate holds hearings on Guantanamo Bay. This is On Point. The Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings on the future of the Guantanamo Bay prison today, a week after figures ranging from Jimmy Carter to Republican Senator Mel Martinez called for its closure following reports of prisoner abuse. More than 500 inmates have been held as enemy combatants at the prison, some for more than 3 years. Only four have been charged. Today, the Senate committee's Republican chairman, Arlen Specter, called for Congress to step up and create legal standards for the prison with clear policy and guidelines.
It's a genuine crazy quilt to try to figure out where the due process rights lie.
Some Democrats, like Vermont's Patrick Leahy, were harsher in their assessments.
Guantanamo Bay is an international embarrassment to our nation, to our ideals, and it remains a festering threat to our security.
Vivica Novak is Washington correspondent for Time magazine and was at today's hearings. Vivica, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you.
So what did you hear in that hearing room today? Is there a wave growing to close it down, or is Guantanamo going to stand?
Well, I think that it's very difficult to tell because you're talking about very small gradations here. But there may be a building sentiment for doing something. Closing it down entirely may or may not be what happens, because it's very hard to do. You've got some people in there that, you know, are pretty scary people. You've afforded them no or very little due process at this point. And, you know, you can't let them out now. But you can't also try them because all their statements have been coerced. I think the Pentagon has really kind of dug itself a hole, and figuring out how to get out of it, maybe release some people, keep some other people, I think that's something that's going to be occupying the thoughts of a lot of people these days.
Vivica, stick with us. I want to hear some more of the exchanges, if we can, from today's hearing. Among those who testified today was Air Force Brigadier General Thomas Hemingway, legal advisor to the Office of Military Commissions. That's the group in charge of trying detainees. Now, in this exchange, Senator Patrick Leahy, Vermont Democrat, asks Hemingway how long the U.S. plans to hold detainees at Guantanamo without charges.
Do we have a plan? I mean, do we have a plan of how much longer these people could be held without any charge?
Senator, we have charges against four people. I can't tell you how long an unprivileged belligerent is going to be held, because I don't know how long this war is going to last. I do know that we are in compliance with the law by holding them.
Well, most say that the war will last for throughout our lifetime. Does that mean that we'll always face, as most other countries have faced, terrorist actions as long as you and I live? Does that mean we could hold them that long without any charges?
I think that we can hold them as long as the conflict endures. But we have, as Admiral McGarrah has already pointed out, a very detailed process for releasing them if they no longer present a threat.
But we now have a government in Afghanistan, yet the conflict continues. Is that what you're saying?
The conflict is not with the government of Afghanistan. The government, the conflict is within a non-state organization.
Vivica Novak, of course, there we've got Patrick Leahy and Brigadier General Thomas Hemingway. And the question is, how long are they going to be there? We see the Bush administration today saying elsewhere, I guess, in perpetuity. That's right. A long time.
Right. The representatives of the administration, people from the Pentagon who were at the hearing, were very tough today. They did not crack at all. But what you do see is, you know, among Republicans, you know, Senator Mel Martinez last week, and there's a little bit of softening in the tone, even George Bush's tone and Alberto Gonzalez's tone, a little bit of softening of the rhetoric about Guantanamo. And what that might presage is unclear because, as I said, it's a very difficult box they've built themselves, but there may be some changes in the future.
But then Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney pushing right back. Let's hear a little bit more here first from Edward Kennedy, Democrat, Massachusetts.
There's no question that Guantanamo has undermined our efforts in the war on terrorism. It stained our reputation on human rights. It's inflamed the Muslim world and became a powerful recruiting tool for terrorists. Its continued existence only makes it more likely that Americans will be attacked by terrorists at home or in other nations throughout the world. Closing Guantanamo makes sense. It's become a symbol of U.S. hypocrisy on human rights, but merely emptying the prison and bulldozing its walls will not cure the illegality. We need a thorough investigation, what happened there, and another detention and interrogation facilities around the world.
A thorough investigation. That sounds almost menacing, but let's hear the opposite view. Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican, Alabama.
This country is not systematically abusing prisoners. We have no policy to do so, and it's wrong to suggest that, and it puts our soldiers at risk who are in this battle because we sent them there, and we have an obligation to them.
So, Vivica, is there oversight here by the Senate that could force a closure at Guantanamo? What are the lines of authority and command here?
The Judiciary Committee does not have much power in this area, and this hearing, while it was certainly fascinating, given all that we've learned lately about Guantanamo, it was not. I don't think it is the forerunner to legislative action that is going to shut down Guantanamo or anything even close to it. I think that initiative is going to have to come from the administration, possibly from the Armed Services Committee. I think it was fascinating that Specter called this hearing today. But I don't think you're gonna see much action out of it.
In part because, as you say, trying to figure out an alternative is so difficult.
It's very difficult because, as I said, you know, we have treated. You know, you just heard Senator Sessions saying that we're not systematically abusing these people. Well, that depends on how you define abuse. You know, our cover story in Time this week talks about this interrogation log we obtained the interrogation of the supposed 20th hijacker.
And it got pretty rough in there.
Yeah, and 4 hours of sleep a night and 20 hours of interrogation every day and, you know, various humiliations and low red light and blasting loud music.
And the notion from Senator Kennedy of an investigation, that must send a chill. Vivica Novak, we're out of time, but we're so grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thanks.
Vivica Novak with Time Magazine, co-author of Inside the Wire, a military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.